You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. 7:30 time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning Tom Hartman, who is author of Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance, and The Theft of Human Rights. Tom is in town for part of his book tour. He'll be speaking today at Elliott Bay Books at 2 o'clock. Tom, thank you for coming in this morning.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, let me start out and ask you, how is it that you came to write this book, Unequal Protection?
Well, I had written an earlier book called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight about the wipeout of the of our ecology, about the kind of planet going down in flames and why. And I was looking a lot of the cultural stories that we tell ourselves. Culture is like the collection of stories that we all agree to pretend are real and behave as if they were, And I identified what I think are a lot of the toxic cultures in our story in that book, things like we're not part of nature, things that we inherited from Aristotle and Descartes. But I kept having this sense that there was something that I was missing, because, it's like if you did everything in that book, still there was this juggernaut that was eating the earth, this corporate juggernaut. And it was like, how did that come about? So I started digging into the writings of Thomas Jefferson, because I was fascinated by democracy. I mean, I grew up with democracy as this iconic thing, this extraordinary, wonderful, beautiful thing. Greece tried it for 200 years and got wiped out, Athens, and then Alexander the Great came in. This was almost 3,000 years ago. And then the second experiment in democracy was us, America. And we so inspired France that they, beheaded the king, and on it went. And reading Jefferson's letters... and he wrote 18,000 letters in his life, and I spent about a year reading as many as I could, probably 4,000 or 5,000 of them. And he kept referring to the three oppressors of men, the traditional oppressors of men. And of course, we all know about the two main ones. One was churches, popes, starting kings, the Crusades and the Inquisitions and whatnot, people who claimed that God told them to do it. And then there were the warlords, who were called kings and queens, who were just seized by brute force and held power by threat of violence. But there was a third one. It turns out that the Boston Tea Party, and I actually found a first-person account published at the end of the 1700s, early 1800s, of the Boston Tea Party. There's 150 guys involved in that thing. They all swore an oath of silence. The only one we know for sure was there was Sam Adams, because he bragged about it, but everybody else was just silent about it. And this guy, George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, wrote a memoir that it was kind of lost to history, and I found the original version of it, and he described it in detail, and I've got big chunks of it in my book. And it turns out that the Boston Tea Party was not a revolt against England. I had learned in high school that the Boston Tea Party was because the Tea Act of 1773, they'd raised the tax on tea in the protest, the colonists' protest. Well, actually what had happened was in 1773 in the Tea Act, they eliminated the tax on tea for the East India Company, which at that time was the largest transnational corporation in the world, and thus allowing the East India Company to wipe out the thousands of small entrepreneurs up and down the East Coast who were importing tea. And this was a revolt against a transnational corporation, and that transnational corporation's influence of the British and the local American governments. It was the first WTO Seattle protest. Seriously, I mean seriously, it was big time, and it's very clear when you read this, read his works, the actual writings from the 1700s, that's what these people were about. And so I kept running across Jefferson referring to this, and I kept running across Hugh, and then I found Hughes's book, and I read that, and I thought, okay, so how did it get where it is today? How did corporations acquire the power that they have when Jefferson was warning against it, and when the American Revolution was fought to throw off a transnational corporation in large part? And that's what led me to do the initial, a couple of years of research that led to the book.
So we're now at a point where it appears that corporations have more rights than any other entity on the planet. It seems that they have the rights of people. They have these other bonus rights on top of that. How did that come to be?
Well, the conventional wisdom and what lawyers learn in law school, and most of our legislators are lawyers, and so they believe this to be true, is that in 1886 there was this Supreme Court case that prior to 1886, from the founding of the country and the writing of the Constitution, you know, in the late 1700s, 1780s, for 100 years, corporations were not persons. They were, well, they were called artificial persons because they had to be able to have some sort of status to be, to own land and pay taxes and things. But they were tightly controlled. There were laws in most states that said, for example, that if an officer of a corporation met with a politician and discussed the business of the corporation, that was considered undue influence, and that person could go to prison. It was a felony. That if an officer of a corporation or a corporation gave money to a politician, that was called bribery, and it was a felony. There are very specific laws that if a corporation advertised in a way that tried to influence an electoral process, since corporations can't vote, they're not citizens, they have no right doing that, and they could lose their charters and be put out of business. There were all these laws that tightly constrained corporate activity. And the railroad corporations in the 1770s, 1780s and 1770s had become sort of like the computer industry of today. I mean, they came out of nowhere and became the largest and most powerful corporations in America in a period of just, you know, a generation. The Civil War really fueled their growth. And the story is that the railroad started, well, after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, which freed the slaves, you know, that gave them the right to vote, that provided against discrimination against them, and the 14th Amendment says that they that all persons, regardless of their race, would have access to equal protection under the law. And the problem was that that 14th Amendment didn't say all natural persons, because, see, at law back in those days, they referred to corporations as artificial persons and human beings as natural persons. It simply said all persons. Now, it starts out, all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States. That's the first sentence of the 14th Amendment. So it's pretty clear that they're talking about human beings because they were born, you know, born or naturalized in the United States. But nonetheless, it says, you know, persons shall not have the right of equal protection abridged. So the railroads started, they were very upset about the fact that local communities were regulating their behavior. Railroads were in most places monopolies. In big cities, of course, they'd join, but, you know, in most places there was just one railroad who ran through in entire states in many cases. And so the local communities would regulate how much they could charge, because back then the corporate laws were that all your books had to be open at all the time for the government, because the corporations are authorized by we the people, you know, by state governments. The word corporation doesn't exist in the Constitution because the founders wanted to make sure that something like the East India Company never rose again. And so they gave the power to regulate corporations to the states so that local folks could keep track of local activities. And the corporations, the railroads were real upset about this. And so they started taking these lawsuits before the Supreme Court saying, you know, you can't tax us at different prices in different counties. That's discrimination. You know, you can't have these different rules for us in different places. That's discrimination. And they used this Free the Slaves Amendment claiming discrimination. Well, repeatedly throughout the 1770s, as they kept advancing this cause, the Supreme Court kept throwing them back, you know, kept throwing it back in their faces and saying, no, sorry, guys, you know, that's not the case. It's not why the 14th Amendment was passed. It was passed to free the slaves, pure and simple. And but finally, in 1886, the story goes that you'll hear in law school and that most people believe, and you'll find in a lot of books, corporations were given the rights of persons. The Supreme Court ruled that they were persons. That the 14th Amendment, because it failed to say natural persons, had to include corporations as well. Well, when I did the research. Excuse me. I wanted to read the decision, you know, because I'd read so much about it. So I went down to one of the neat things about living in Vermont is, like, you know, you can walk into the governor's office and he's sitting there at his desk going, "Hi, how are you?" And so I walked into the Supreme Court building, and the guy who runs the library there, Paul Donovan, I said, "Paul, I'm looking for this 1886 ruling." And so he takes me back into this old dusty stack of books, and he says, "Here's the original book published in 1889, you know, the U.S. reports," and this old creaky, cracky, you know, kind of falling apart thing. And I'm reading through the decision, and the decision says that it was a fence post case, this actual case. The railroad was saying that the state should have assessed the fence posts, but the county assessed the fence posts for tax purposes, and, And that was their main argument. And the court agreed with them. They said, yep, you know, the wrong person assessed the fence posts and threw it back down to the lower court. So, and at the end of the decision, the court points out that there were a series of arguments made before the court, including the argument that corporations are persons, and that the court chose not to rule on any of these constitutional issues. So I'm reading the decision, and the decision says, this court never ruled that corporations are persons. So I went to Paul, and I said, Paul, I'm missing something here, because I've been hearing, you know, and for 120 years, you know, it's a... And Paul says, well, you know, I'm not a lawyer. He says, but look at this part of it. And there's this little fine print at the front of the page before the decision. And the first sentence of the fine print says, corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection under the law. And I said, what's that? And he said, that's the headnote. He said, that wasn't written by the Supreme Court. That was written by the reporter of the court, who was an employee of the banks and Biddle, I think, was the company, the publishing company in New York that publishes the book. And it's just, you know, a commentary. And I said, does it have the force of law? And he said, I don't think so, but you need to talk to the lawyer. So I made the copies of the thing, went around the corner to the office, walked down the street and around the corner to the office of Jim Ridfo, who's an old friend of mine, who's a lawyer, you know, went to law school. Said, you know, Jim, you know about the 1886 case? And he, oh, yeah, that's when corporations became persons. And I said, well, here's the case. And I laid it out on his desk, you know, and I had highlighted these parts. I said, read it. And he's reading it, and he goes, well, this isn't what we learned in school. And I said, now look at the headnote. And he reads the headnote, and he goes, holy cow. Well, he was a little more expletive than that. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, this thing says clearly corporations are not persons, but the headnote says that they are. And he says, the headnote's wrong. And I said, well, you know, how'd that happen? And he said, well, there's mistakes in law books all the time. He said, one of the first things they train lawyers in law school is not to read headnotes because, you know, that's just a commentary. It's not legal. And I said, but you know, 120 years of American law have been based on this. You know, I was starting to sound hysterical, you know. And Jim is like, well, you know, these mistakes happen. He said, but you need to talk to somebody who really knows constitutional law. So I got on the phone and I called up the Secretary of State in Vermont, you know, and Deb Markowitz, who's the Secretary of State. And again, she answers her own phone. You know, hi there, Deb. And, you know, you don't know me, but I'm a writer and I'm working on this. And I told her the story of it. And she said, well, you know, she said, headnotes don't have precedent. They are not law. There was a 1905 Supreme Court case, in fact, in which the Supreme Court ruled that headnotes don't have law, don't have precedent. So the whole idea that corporations should be entitled to human rights, which is the important next step in our conversation, I think, was a lie. Turns out it was a lie. The whole thing, it was a theft. That's why I say the theft of human rights. Corporations stole human rights by co-opting the court reporter. Turns out the court reporter was a former president of a railroad, and he just wrote that in.
That is incredible. So, but it begs the question then of, so is everything that followed that then debatable now? I mean, can we fix it?
Well, yes and no. What happened was that there were several cases that followed this in the 1890s that referenced the headnotes in the 1886 case, but then continued to say the corporations are persons, therefore they should have rights to free speech. They should have rights to privacy. They should have rights to not have to self-incriminate. They should have rights against discrimination. And once the Supreme Court, even though the basis of its ruling was wrong, once it ruled that this was the case, then that actually became the precedent. So it is the law of the land that corporations are persons, even though it's based on a lie, and the Supreme Court has never, ever had an argument about this before it in which it made a decision. And there's no legislation ever been passed, no president has ever talked about it. In fact, the presidents have said the exact opposite. You know, the presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower have warned us explicitly about the power of corporations being persons. So what happened was once corporations had this power, when Jefferson and Madison were putting together the Bill of Rights, what they wanted to do was build an absolute wall between government, which could live forever and could accumulate power and could potentially one day oppress its citizens because they had just overthrown such a government, between government on the one hand and the rights of individual citizens on the other hand. So they wanted to give this enormous club to the citizens so that they could beat back government if it ever became oppressive. And that club is the right of assembly, the right of free speech, the right not to incriminate yourself, the right to a trial by your peers, the right to privacy, and the right against discrimination, which was passed after the Civil War, and what we call the Bill of Rights, and the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 15th Amendments. And prior to 1886, corporations didn't have access to those things because they're not human beings. The logic was they can't vote, so why are they involved? They shouldn't be involved in the electoral process. They don't breathe fresh air. In fact, they're polluting our air, so we need to regulate their behavior so they don't ruin our air, because we're biological systems. We need fresh air. They don't need water to drink. So, there is employees of corporations, but the corporation itself is, the legal entity. So once this 1886 non-ruling happened and was ratified in the 1890s, corporations very quickly started saying, okay, if we're persons, we should have the First Amendment right of free speech. We should be able to talk to politicians. And literally thousands of laws in states across the United States that had made it a crime for corporations to lobby politicians were struck down. Laws that made it a crime for corporations to give money to politicians were struck down. And corporations began to subsume the political process. There was a backlash to this in the early 1900s, the populist movement, which led to the passage of the 17th Amendment in 1912, which caused us to directly elect the Senate. Before that, the Senate was actually appointed by the state legislatures, and so it was, kind of represented the wealthy and the powerful. But there's an interesting history there. But the point of it is that, so first of all, they started claiming First Amendment rights, and that, kind of weaseled them into the political process, where they're well established now. That's why things like McCain-Feingold are so problematic. We can't control corporations, so McCain-Feingold regulates politicians instead of corporations. I mean, that's what we're left with. It's this weakness. They used corporate personhood. They said, we should have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy, and there was a famous chemical company that the EPA wanted to check out, that they were, polluting the environment. There was a whistleblower, and the EPA came in and said, we want to check your factory, and the chemical company said, nope, we have the Fourth Amendment to privacy. You can't do that. So the EPA flies a small plane over the factory and takes pictures. And the chemical company took that all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court ruled, hey, companies have the right to privacy. Similarly with OSHA. OSHA inspectors have been locked out of corporate offices. They can't inspect the workplace. Unions are, going crazy about this, but this is, and unions, by the way, are not persons under the law, although corporations and humans are. Strange, bizarre thing here, but that's a whole other topic. And so the right of privacy has allowed them to, for example, allowed the tobacco companies to hide what they knew since the 1930s about the addictive and deadly potentials of nicotine, and on it goes. And it's what's being used now. Corporations claim trade secrets, so that they don't, a lot of the Enron thing was possible because corporations were able to hide their crimes behind the Fourth Amendment shield of privacy. The Fifth Amendment, the Takings Clause, the Double Jeopardy Clause, and the right against self-incrimination. Again, we don't have to talk about the fact that we know that we're committing crimes because that would be self-incrimination. And the 14th Amendment, the Penny Corporation, J.C. Penney, sued the state of Florida back in the 1930s, saying that it was illegal discrimination, that in Florida, as in every other state in the country, there were laws that encouraged small local businesses and made it more difficult and more expensive for large out-of-state corporations to operate in those states. And it was, for obvious reasons. They wanted to keep the community intact and the local businesses intact. Penny came in and said, this is unconstitutional discrimination under the 14th Amendment, which was designed to free the slaves. You're discriminating against us as if we were, black people or, freed slaves. And the Supreme Court said, well, I guess if in 1886 they said they're persons, then they must be right, and they agreed with them. And that's why it's so hard for communities to keep out Walmarts and things like that now. So we have this original theft of human rights. And now, once this enormous club that was, appropriately given to humans to constrain government, that government should be, as Lincoln said, of the people, by the people, for the people, that this enormous club to keep government at bay that was given to we humans was given to corporations. With their enormous power, they've used it to co-opt our governmental process and essentially seize control of our governments. An interesting anecdote or an interesting footnote on this is that this happened in 1886, right, theoretically. In 1872, another group of people came before the Supreme Court and said, we'd like to be people. That was women, Bradville versus Illinois case. And the court said, nope, women are not persons. In fact, they ruled that the soul and pervading purpose of women was to be a wife and helpmate to their husbands, and that they had no legal status independent of their husbands. Then in 1896, freed slaves. A guy named Plessy, the son of a slave, hopped on a railroad car, went in the white compartment, got thrown off, got on, got arrested, took it to the Supreme Court, Plessy versus Ferguson case, and said, you know, we'd like to be persons too. After all, the amendment was passed for us. And the Supreme Court said, no, we don't think so, and instituted apartheid in the United States, segregation, which... Now, the good news is that in 1954, in Brown versus Board of Education, the court reversed itself in the Plessy case and said, gee, we made a mistake. I guess, you know, non-whites, you know, African-Americans and other people who are of not just, you know, white European ancestry should be persons in the United States. And in 1973, in Roe v. Wade, the court said, you know, gee, we made a mistake in the Bradwell case in 1872, and women should be persons. They should have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy. So it's possible that the court could reverse itself and say, you know, we made a mistake. Corporations, you know, they can't breathe. They're not alive. They're not human beings. So why are we giving them human rights? And that's my hope that this can be changed.
There are some people who have said that the whole creation of the United States was to formulate a country that would be perfect for corporations, perfect for large companies. Mm. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that was the big dynamic tension between the Federalists, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, John Adams, and what came to be called the Democratic Republicans, which we now call the Democratic Party. And the Federalists kind of died out and then got reincarnated as the Republican Party just before the Civil War. And that tension, I think that it was good intentions on all part. Alexander Hamilton and John Adams really believed that if the United States was going to be powerful enough to fight back the imperial European forces, because Spain and France and England still had a toehold on North America, that if we were going to be powerful enough, we had to have these big corporations. The first battle was over the Bank of the United States. Hamilton wanted to create a federal bank that could, you know, take the state's debts from the Revolutionary War and pay them back. And so they had this vision of this huge industrial America. Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, on the other hand, had this vision of, well, America might move in that direction, but we have to be very, very careful that nothing like the East India Company ever rises again, where we've got a corporation so large that it can influence government and that it can overwhelm local communities. And that's why they fought so hard to include in the Bill of Rights an 11th Amendment that would ban corporate monopolies. Of course, they lost. You know, the ghost of Thomas Jefferson has to be sitting around right now going, I told you so, told you so. But I think that in both cases, they believed that was the best thing for the country. I don't see villains here. I just see differences of opinion. You read the Federalist Papers, it's pretty obvious that's what was going on.
So tell us about what's being done about this. Are there any inspiring examples that you can give us to change things back to the way they once were, perhaps?
Well, it's incredible. As people are hearing about this, you know, as the result of a small number of organizations are starting to wake up, parts of the Green Party are starting to talk about this in Arizona, in particular the Greens in Arizona are talking about actually amending the Constitution of Arizona to eliminate corporate personhood in 2006. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which was founded back in 1819, I think, by Jane Addams, it's had two Nobel Prize winners as its presidents. It was responsible in large part for the passage of women's suffrage, the right of women to vote, the 20th Amendment. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom has kicked, and WILF is their, WILF.org is their website, WILPF, has kicked off a 3-year campaign to end corporate personhood. They've got these bumper stickers that say abolish corporate personhood that you can get on their website, and a whole educational campaign. The POCLAD, the program on corporations, law, and democracy, is educating people. But beyond that, local communities are actually starting to stand up and say, hey, enough. The city of Point Arena, California, in 2000 passed a non-binding resolution, which wasn't law, but it's like helping to wake people up. I mean, that's always the first step, whether it was abolition or women's suffrage. It's first we have to wake people up. And they passed a resolution saying, we believe corporations aren't persons. In the meantime now, we have 10 communities in Pennsylvania and a couple of in a few other states, North Dakota, I think there's one in Wisconsin. But the 10 in Pennsylvania are the most visible, where the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF.org, CELDF, has actually passed laws. CELDEF didn't pass the laws. The elected officials in these local communities have passed laws saying that corporations can't own farms. And they're doing this to keep out these giant agribiz, you know, giant hog farms and things. And of course, to say a corporation can't own a farm is to say a corporation isn't a person. And this is creating an enormous legal battle, which may well make it to the Supreme Court, which, you know, if enough communities around America do this, eventually the court will be given an opportunity to reverse its mistake, just as it did with women and with freed slaves. And so in the back of the book, and also on my website, we just put it there, anybody can download it, we hired CELDEF's attorneys to look at the state constitutions of all 50 states and come up with an ordinance that a local town, township, county, community, unincorporated area can pass, that any local government can pass, saying, in our town, corporations are not persons. And it refers to the specific police powers acts within the constitution of each individual state that give the towns the right to do that. We additionally went through the constitutions of all 50 states and figured out where we need to insert the word natural before the word person in order to get corporations out of this business. And we are suggesting that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States be amended to insert the word natural before the word person. And, you know, any one of those three things or a Supreme Court decision would be enough to change the tide. And so we're encouraging people to do all those things, because as with abolition and as with women's suffrage, it's not any one thing. It's a critical mass. And the first step, of course, is waking up as many people as possible. And the second is taking local and direct action. So the book is kind of a handbook, and the last third of the book is a handbook on how to do that. And like I said, on the website, which is unequalprotection.com, we've got all those laws right there. You know, you can just download them for free and print them out and turn it into a petition and get it on the city council agenda and, you know, roll with it.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. I don't know if we have enough time I wanted to ask you about if you saw any connections between the injustices that have you've recorded in your book and the current state we have right now, where the United States is threatening to up its ante in the war with Iraq.
Yeah, there's a chapter about that in the book, actually, you know, that goes back to Eisenhower's warning. Eisenhower pointed out that before World War II, we didn't have a defense industry in the United States. We had companies like General Motors that made cars, and in time of war they would switch over and make tanks, you know. But then after the war they would stop making the tanks. And once in the early 50s a permanent defense industry emerged, Eisenhower was very alarmed by this. And he said, we have to be very careful. We must, you know, never drop our vigilance that this industry doesn't gain so much power that it can influence government. I would suggest to you that the enormous oil profits and the enormous war profits to be made in the Middle East, while perhaps not the single largest driving force, although there are conspiracy theorists who claim that it is, I honestly don't know, is certainly a very powerful driving force for this Pax Americana, for the Pax, you know, American, what some people are referring to as American imperialism, that, you know, this new doctrine that was just released a week or two ago that essentially says what the Third Reich did, what the British Empire did in the 1700s, and what the Romans did 2,000 years ago is now going to be our policy. And that the concept of corporate personhood and corporations having so much power that they can be the tail that wags the dog of government has not just something to do with that, but a lot to do with that. And again, we can fix that. You know, in biological systems, when you've got a single cell or a single part of an organism whose only value is growth, and it takes over the organism, that's called cancer. And that's what's happened in the body politic of America.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time talking this morning with Tom Hartman, who is author of Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance, and The Theft of Human Rights. And Tom, you are speaking today in town.
Yeah, 2 o'clock at Elliott Bay Books. I'm going to be giving a talk about this and signing books and answering questions. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Are you leaving a lot of time there for answering questions?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. I'll spend the afternoon there. Yeah.
Very good. All right, well, I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate your inviting me.